A story for another day.
Yeah.
Okay, so at the end here, we're over by 5 seconds. I always forget to do this, too. This is Man vs. Mob Radio that you've been listening to, and I'm your host, Patrick Clerkin, but I am also the host of the Man vs. Mob podcast, and that is available on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on www.manvmobpodcast.com. It's a V, not a VS, so find it. Find me on social media, Instagram at @manvmobpodcast, and that's it.
I got my shameless plug.
Okay.
We're on the College Station right now, very eclectic music. People that listen to it tend to have a very good taste in music. Will DePiano, that's DePiano. Will is a musician. You should check him out. I manage him. I am a little bit vested in the whole thing. Also, Wax On, our buddy Dan Cady's band, is phenomenal. If you don't know Wax On, you should check them out. They're local boys out there in Lowell.
Awesome. Thanks, Chris. Good job plugging them. Bye, everybody.
95 WMFO Medford.
This is Mark Bell, and you're listening to WMFO in Medford.
Thank you, Mark. We have in the studio here Mark Bell, the lead singer of Thunder Train, the Joe Perry Project, and the Mark 5. Thank you for coming in today, Mark.
It's great to be here, Michael.
And you have a brand spanking new book called Once a Rocker, Always a Rocker. Can you give us a little overlay of what the book is about?
It's a memoir that takes place... Takes place right here in United States, all over the states and beyond, but a lot of it takes place right down the street on Broadway, 354 Broadway in Cambridge, where Tufts University right here. And I lived down on Broadway at that time, and that was when I got the call to join the Joe Perry Project, of all people. It kind of was not something that I was expecting. Who expects to ever get to be in a band with Joe Perry? He had left Aerosmith. He was looking for a singer. I was out of work and living in my parents' basement, and a week later I was on the road. I kept a diary through all that time, the next 2.5 years. So the memoir covers February of 83 through of 82, all through 83, and ends in May of 1984, just on the brink of Aerosmith reuniting. That's the focus of the book, but of course I talk a lot about where I came from and what I'd been doing before, which was the whole Boston rock scene.
Now, you were not originally from this area.
No, but yes.
Yeah.
I was born in Ohio, Yellow Springs, Ohio. My parents were in college at Antioch College, but that's just something that I like to throw around. I mean, Rick Ocasek went to that college, and Richie Fiore of Poco was born in that town, and Rod Serling went to school at Antioch with my parents. But me, by the time I was like 6 months old, I was in Holliston, Massachusetts.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Now, when you first entered the music scene here, you were in a band. Was this your first band, Thunder Train, or was there bands before that?
Well, those were the Mechanical Onions in 1966.
There you go.
I don't know how you missed the Mechanical Onions. Yeah, you know, I was really into the garage rock of the time, bands like The Remains and The Lost and Multi and The Barbarians and of course, The Stones and The British Invasion. And I was really into The Yardbirds, having a rave up with The Yardbirds. And I was a guitarist. I was actually a lead guitarist as a little kid. And I played the teen center circuit.
Yeah.
And the whole New England teen scene. It used to be a magazine we used to buy.
There used to be youth clubs. I remember going to one in New Hampshire with my cousin Ronnie. Mm-hmm. And it was called Ackerman's, and it was for people under 21. Because that was before the drinking law was changed.
Exactly. And that was when going out, listening to music and dancing to music was what boys and girls wanted to do. When I first started going to dances, bands, you know, local bands hadn't quite got it together, so they'd have like a record hop, and then the local band that knew two songs, yeah. Wipeout and Gloria,
yeah.
would do their two tunes, and then it would go back to a DJ spinning the records. But, you know, a few months later, a couple guys had figured out how to do a whole set, and then it was off to the races, and Mechanical Onions were part of that race. Yeah, just like you say, yeah. we had the Wellesley Teen Center, the Medway Teen Center, the Medfield Teen Center. Every town either had that or an Ararat we had in Holliston.
You probably had like Y's and CYOs and stuff like that?
Oh, yeah. CYO dances, all the church halls, and the high school dances.
Yeah.
The high schools would hire the bands. So that was a really amazing time to come up. It was still the fumes of Beatlemania, yeah. just drove everybody wild, and we had Where the Action Is every day on TV in the afternoon when we got home, and Hullabaloo and Shindig. There was a lot of, not to mention Ed Sullivan Show yeah. on Sunday. So rock was everywhere. It wasn't until 1970. The 70s, early 70s, when I started to, I made the change mm-hmm. from a lead guitarist to being a singer, mm-hmm. which was kind of it was only because this drummer scouted me. I was playing guitar and singing in a band because my singer didn't show up, yeah. so I was...
You elected.
And yeah, he said, come join my band. I said, okay, I'll bring my guitar. And he said, don't bring your guitar, just come down and sing. I said, sing? You kidding?
Yeah.
He said, yeah. I like how what you do with the crowd. Yeah. So all I needed was that little push. I'd already been seeing this local band at the Teen Center Lakeview Ballroom called Aerosmith. Mm-hmm. And Steven Tyler was doing these moves on stage that I hadn't seen before. And I'd been going to see, the Boston Tea Party. I started going when I was 15 to see Rod Stewart with the Jeff Beck Group, some really great showmen like, what was his name? Crazy World of Arthur Brown,
oh, yeah.
Fire,
yeah.
and Steppenwolf when they started. I saw John Kay. I saw all these great front men, but I just couldn't see myself doing that. But then when I saw Steven Tyler, I said, this guy, he's doing it in my own teen center, and he's not that much older than me. Mm. And so next thing I knew, Thunder Train started to happen.
Now, when Thunder Train started, that would have probably been near the early to mid-70s, correct?
74.
Yeah, and the landscape in Boston, I don't know if people know that, it was mostly cover bands and jazz and folk. And there was a club called the Ratskeller, originally called TJ's Ratskeller. Excuse me, and they started to take... a chance on local bands. Everybody know Mickey Clean, the Mez kind of opened the door, but I was going down there and I would see bands like Thunder Train or Ready Teddy. But at that time, you did have an album out, and there was bands like Aerosmith had come out, and Jay Giles, and Duke and the Drivers, and I said Ready Teddy, and you guys. What was the feeling at the time? Because a few years early was that whole Boss Town sound debacle. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people seemed to be kind of burnt on Boston bands. I mean, the bands were good. It was a hype thing.
It was a hype.
And, you know, how did you guys feel about going into it? It's like, okay, this is like the second chance, or this is our time, or you just went full speed ahead.
Yeah, well, it's funny because each of those years seemed like a decade, and sometimes months seemed like a year. So changes, definitely the Boss Town's sound was something that left everybody kind of reeling, because there was a lot of good talent in that wave.
Lothar and the Hand People, Ultimate Spinach, who had an interesting person in their band, Skunk Baskerville.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Yeah, and there was a few other bands, Beacon Street Union.
Yeah. And, who are the guys from up in Marblehead? C-Train were unbelievable.
Yeah.
They were great. Earth Opera were fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Fluff. There were some really, Eaton's Children, a lot of good ones.
Wasn't one, Peter Wolf was in, I think.
Well, he was in the Hallucinations, which were like the biggest show band at the Tea Party. I don't think they got swept up, luckily. Willie was playing in Bagatelle.
Yes.
They weren't part of the Boss Town scene. that whole thing happened, and then there was this little window after that where Jay Giles and Aerosmith got signed, and then, like you say, there was the Ready Teddy, the Sidewinders,
the Duke and the Drivers,
there was Daddy Warbucks, Punky Meadows, and Ralph Mormon singing. This was the scene that Thunder Train came into, and we wanted to play. Cacades was the name of it. Remember, it had that stutter in it?
It was the whole, called the Kenmore Club, and it was three clubs in one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Henry Vara owned the whole thing, and Cacades was like, I think, the biggest rock room that you'd want to play. Yeah. That's where the New York Dolls had done a week, and Aerosmith had done a week. Thunder Train would go in, try to get a week, might get a day, a Sunday or something. There was the Groggery in Alston we'd also play.
Yeah.
The Rathskeller at that point in 74 was Jimmy Harold, I don't think, had come in yet, owning it. I don't know who owned it.
And they were in a transition. I think in the documentary I saw, he was there. And they were still doing cover bands, and then they asked him to come back, and he bought the place, and he just said, I'm going to switch this thing up. So it would have to be like 74-ish?
Yeah, and that's when we were playing there, and it was just a nothing room.
Yeah.
It had no character at all, and, it was just a bunch of guys in Red Sox hats sitting around down there that, the groupies and the cool kids hadn't discovered it, that's for sure. It was just this place that was, you could four wall it, you go in, they wouldn't pay you, but you could put a guy at the door, and if anybody wandered in. So, we'd play there occasionally and didn't think anything of it. It wasn't until that summer of 76 when the magic happened and everything started happening really fast.
Yeah.
Thunder Train's album, or our album hadn't come out yet. Our single Hot for Teacher had hit, and not only was it playing at these college stations, but it was also playing on WBCN, the 50,000-watt giant, as well as WCOZ, the other 50,000-watt giant. Plus you had all those bands you mentioned, Ready Teddy, Willie, Mickey Clean and the Mez, Fox Pass. All these bands are coming up, plus writers and the Boston Groupie News and photographers. And there's energy coming from all these different directions. And a magic started to happen really fast.
I remember that Newsweek did a thing on punk, and they did Los Angeles, New York, and Boston. And when they featured Boston, it was just in its infancy, and they got the Inflictors. And Lee Ritter had a song that said, Black Betty, Bam-a-Lam. I remember that directly.
That's right.
But I think a lot of people down there initially thought it was in full swing, but it wasn't. It was kind of a slow meandering, but it finally got in steam within months, and that place was humming.
It's amazing. I mean, I was just looking at my old diaries of that time before I came out here, and we didn't really start to play the Rat as the Rat we know it until the summer of 76. First, there was the club called The Club here in Cambridge.
Yeah, it was originally called the Asa Club.
Okay.
And then it was called The Club.
Yeah.
And then it became Night Stage.
That was where Thunder Train made their entree into the this new wave scene.
Yeah.
It was Willie Alexander was trying to put out his second single, Hit Her With the Axe, and he didn't have the money to do it, so... we came up with the idea of doing a benefit, which was kind of a new idea at the time.
Yeah.
Local bands hadn't done a benefit. And we got the Atlantics and several of the other really happening bands and Willie, and we did this benefit. That was at the beginning of the summer of 76. By the end of the summer, we did our first week at the Rat, and then that fall, we recorded the Live at the Rat album.
Oh.
And at the same time, we were recording our Thunder Train Teenage Suicide album.
What label was that on?
Rat was on Rat Records, and Teenage Suicide was on Jelly Records, which was run by the Duke and the Drivers team of Earthquake Morton, the bass player, and Nighthawk Jackson, the guitarist.
Yeah. You guys must have been pretty psyched because most bands in Boston did not have any product out.
Right. All it was Willie had his Mass Ave single, and Spoon Fed Records had Ready Teddy, and Thunder Train were on Jelly Records. Of course, we wanted to be signed to the big 100,000.
Yeah.
Which, months later, as soon as the Rat album came out in the beginning of 77, Jim Harold, the owner of the Rat, brought all of the 10 bands from the Live at the Rat to CBGB's for a week.
Yeah.
And that was the week that all the record companies came to see what this Live at the Rat was, and that's where Willie ended up being signed to MCA, where Real Kids ended up being signed to Red Star, where Sire picked up DMZ.
Yeah.
Thunder Train was still on Jelly Records. We just couldn't... We were confusing because Thunder Train was... We were part of us was a mainstream rock act.
Yeah, kind of like an Aerosmith.
Like an Aerosmith, although we would die before we would admit that.
Yeah.
We'd say we were like the Stones or we were like the New York Dolls, but we were jealous of Aerosmith.
How much of an influence was New York Dolls? I just had a interesting conversation with my friend Greg Allen's from The Religion about the influence of the New York Dolls, how they broke all the rules, and a lot of people maybe will admit or not admit that they were either seen them or influenced by them.
They were a huge influence on especially the Thunder Train was around so long, we went through different stages like a lot of bands do. When we started in 74, not only did we wear the same girl clothes and high silver boots and everything that you saw on the Dolls album, but we also boldly claimed that we were from New York City, which shocked the kids in Holliston and Natick, who had just seen us at the teen center growing up like every week. Oh, now you're from New York City. Okay. But that was what we did. So the New York Dolls and bands like Silverhead and Mott the Hoople and Spiders from Mars, that's what the early Thunder Train was, a glitter rock act. And then we morphed into more of a Exile on Main Street type of Stonesy act. And then when the whole punk thing came up, we had enough insanity and anger and high energy in our act that we could work well with bands like DMZ and Inflictors or whoever.
Well, you were part of that whole Rat family.
So we were part of the Rat family and could do Max's Kansas City and CBGB's, but then the next week we'd be up in Rutland, Maine, playing at a real straight kind of week-long rock club, the kind you were talking about at the beginning of the interview.
Yeah.
Because we knew a bunch of those old Mott the Hoople songs and Stones classics that we used to play, a few of those to begin the night. And then we'd segue into our own original material.
Yeah.
Just enough to keep the club owner happy and keep the dance floor full. Because that's where you'd make your money.
Yeah.
You make your money playing up in Maine someplace. but even though there's no pretty girls or no record company people in the audience. And then you go to New York and you do this big showcase gig and John Belushi's there, but you're not getting paid hardly anything.
I think we're going to do a PSA. And we have two songs we found. You can decide which one you want us to play. I'm so excited. I've got to rock. Which would you like to hear?
I found Hot for Teacher as well.
Okay. Which one would you like to hear, Mark?
I'd love to hear Hot for Teacher.
Okay.
All right. Let's do that aforementioned PSA, and we'll do that and then come back and chat with you some more.
I'm Joe Perry.
And Steven Tyler from Aerosmith, here for RAD, recording artists, actors, and athletes against drunk driving. Yeah, you know we love it when the music does the talking.
And you know, the music stops when someone gets killed.
So never, 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 never let someone you know get behind the wheel if they've been drinking. So keep it real, keep it real. Friends, don't let friends drive drunk.
A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Showing up, and thanks for screaming real loud, because we're playing real loud. It's called Take a Walk with Miss Sally.
It's WMFO Medford. It's Mike Newman and Mike Stewart and our guest Mark Bell. Yeah. And we just heard Joe Perry Project, Take a Walk with Sally. You can tell they're from New England because that's what it sounds like sometimes when your car won't start in the morning. We were sitting here laughing, listening to it. It was pretty fun to listen to. Then Todd for Teacher before that with Thunder Train. And back to Mark and talking about the book and everything we're doing.
Well, in front of us right now, we have three things. We have the book, we have the album, and the book and the album are called Once a Rocker, Always a Rocker. And you're also on a compilation, The Best of the Joe Perry Project. The music still does the talking. So now this brings us into the Joe Perry part of, and the book part of the interview. Okay, you got the call. What happens next?
Well, what happened is I got the call. They said, we want you to audition for the Joe Perry Project. And I was so crushed and had been through so much seeing my dreams destroyed with the Thunder Train. I don't think it's just in music. I don't care whether you think you're going to be a pro hockey player or you want to be in the Olympics or you want to be a jockey or a painter or whatever your dream is. You get to a point when you're 29 years old and you've been put down and knocked down so many times that I just didn't want to get my hopes up again. I didn't want to audition for Joe Perry and be said, nah, you're not quite right. So I said no, and I hung up the phone. And then I went in the corner. I was in the, I was in the cellar of my dad's stereo shop in Wellesley, and I was too rough to be up on the sales floor, so I was down in the cellar fixing, cleaning up dirty record players and changing needles and styluses. And then I started kicking myself. So what did you just do? Why did you say no? Models, jets, touring the world, recording with Joe Perry. Come on, man. And then I was so depressed, and then the phone rang again, and it was Joe Perry's manager saying, we're not going to take no for an answer. You got to come down to Cambridge this Friday and audition. Here's the six songs you got to learn.
Was that the rehearsal complex in Airwife?
Yes, except it was a kind of a secret annex behind the one that we all knew.
Okay.
And that's where the project was holed up. Yeah, and it was great because Brad Whitford was there as well on the day I auditioned. And we got going, and everything was great except that Joe Perry was in really bad physical condition. He was shaking. He obviously had something very wrong going on. But because we had Brad in the band, Joe's good friend and also an incredible musician, we were able to pull a good set together, and within a month we were out on the road and we were playing, and that went great for a couple of weeks. And then Brad got a better offer out in LA and he left the project. And so we started our first American tour, and we got 6 days into the tour when Joe had a total seizure on stage in front of 1,000 people, and we had to stop the tour. We all had to come back to Boston, and then it was a long period of Joe getting things together. He had a lot of different things going on with his old Aerosmith management, a lot of pressure from them, a lot of pressure from his wife, a lot of pressure from people he owed money to, and a lot of physical things that he was having to deal with because of whatever toxic excess was going on. We got through that, and then, man, after that, July 4th, 82, we came back on a date with Joan Jett and the Stray Cats, and we absolutely were fantastic. Joe was fantastic, and the rest of us held on and hung on to, and then boom, off we went. And then we played the States, East Coast, West Coast, down to South America, Canada. Everything was great, except for me as a lead singer, it was a little tricky because we weren't touring our own new album.
Yeah.
So my voice was something that nobody was expecting, and It's hard being a singer with Joe, as Steven Tyler would tell you, especially back in those days. as you heard at the end of that last tune, in that where somewhere in America and some dive, you know, Joe would let it go. I'd be over singing just to be heard, to hear myself. And but what I mean is, if I'm in Van Halen and I get rid of my singer, David Lee Roth, and I get a new singer, or AC/DC and my singer dies and I need a new singer, I go into the studio and I record a new album with my new singer before I go out on tour, so that the kids have somebody to listen to out in the parking lot and know this new singer. Whereas with Joe Perry Project, I was out there for months, and in fact over a year, with no record of my own.
So you were doing not just the older Project stuff and some, maybe an Aerosmith tune, but you were doing maybe Pills by the Dolls or something, and whatever, you know, whatever other things he was pulling. So
whatever Joe decided to play. Yeah. And so for the first time in my career, well, I did in Thunder Train do some cover tunes, but we were mostly an original band. And suddenly with the Joe Perry Project, we were an original band, but the singer, me, was a cover singer. I was singing Steven Tyler tunes and Charlie Farron tunes and Ralph Moorman tunes. This was difficult for me because I don't sound
well. You want
like
your
those
you
guys.
Want your own, you know, your own mark.
Yeah,
yeah.
I want my own mark.
So when you got your album, you did.
We finally got the album over a year into the tour. We finally signed a deal with MCA. We were in the middle of recording the album, and we got dropped by the label. I go into it in the diary, and it's a usual hairy story. We continued on with the album, even though we didn't know who would release it, if anybody would release it. But our manager Tim was able to get us back on track, even though MCA I don't think ever loved us very much, but they did. They did put out the record, and then off we went again on the road, and that was finally I had some cred.
Yeah.
I was on a record. The band, your cousin, I'm talking to Michael Scott Stewart here, and his cousin is Ronnie Stewart, the great drummer who was the second longest lasting member of the Joe Perry Project. He was with it from 79 when Joe left Aerosmith to start the project, and Ronnie played on the first two Columbia records, and he continued on in the band when I was with the group for over a year. For just over a year he was with us. Ron was a real serious drummer who I think his heart, especially by the time I was in the band, he would have been more happy, I think, in a prog rock situation like an Asia or a King Crimson, because he really had amazing chops, incredible. And while the rest of us would be up in the front of the van listening to Joe Perry play his Sex Pistols album over and over and over again, and Danny Hargrove, our bass player, and I would be cutting up and doing just crazy things that you do. We were traveling in a van all over the States. This was not luxury coaches. Very, very occasionally we'd get to ride People Express Airways down to Florida or something, but normally we'd just be in our van. And Danny and I'd be cutting up. Joe would be blasting the Sex Pistols, and your cousin would be in the back with his headphones on listening to Bill Bruford tapes and playing his drum pad.
Wow.
And I think I think he finally got tired of, because me anyway, in the music I was writing with Joe that we were demoing, I wasn't really aspiring to be like a Kansas.
Yeah.
I was aspiring to be more like, you know, an electrified Little Richard or a Sex Pistols. That my roots are in garage rock, and I like that kind of pared down rock and roll, really rough. And I'm not really looking for all kinds of technique. And so then we, in the middle, before we finally did do the MCA album, we got Joe Pett, another great Boston drummer, who gave the group a whole new feel. It still was a hard rocking outfit, but I think Pat felt more comfortable with where the direction we were in at that point. So it released some tension.
I had asked you off air what you think were the high points of your book and some of the low points of the book. I think we had talked a little bit in the green room about, you know, the transition, you know, back into Aerosmith and then the brief little flirtation with Alice Cooper.
Mm. Yeah, that was a weird day when we were in Hollywood, and Joe told the road manager before we went back to our hotel, we had to go up into the Hollywood Hills. He had to talk to somebody, and we realized that we were at Shep Gordon's house. Joe went in and to talk with Alice Cooper, and so the rest of us are just out there baking in the van while Joe's in there talking about who knows what. It turned out that Alice was interested in writing some songs and maybe get a band together to do a tour, and Joe would be the guitarist. Danny and I didn't quite believe that was all going to go down, because we knew that the project had a lot of dates on the book at the time. But that's the kind of weird thing. That's a day in the life of the project. That was the, you know, one day you're in Venezuela playing in a 20,000-seat arena with a cable down the middle of it, with all the women on one side of the cable and all the men on the other side of the cable. And fires breaking out in the back of the arena where people are dumping trash cans and lighting the contents on fire. And this is all in an inside arena. This isn't in a stadium. And nobody stops the show to put out the fires. Yeah. You'd be doing that one night, and then the next night you're out in front of Alice Cooper's house having a tailgate party. And then the next night you're in some weird dive in Lynn, Massachusetts. Yeah, it was just... So ups and downs. My book, Once a Rocker, Always a Rocker, is really different from a lot. I read all these memoirs, rock and roll memoirs, and they usually start out with the kids in the station wagon and building up, and they finally get the deal, and they finally have a hit, and then they become very corporate, and then they're flying all over the place, and then they overextend themselves with drugs and alcohol, and they end up in rehab. My book starts out almost with Joe having to go to rehab. Mm. We start out, and we do a little bit, and then the rehab. But after that, it's the long struggle begins.
Yeah.
And we struggle and struggle. And we finally get that record deal, and that is when we find, and I mean, that was a high point. We're out on the Boston party, the Boston Tea Party ship that sits out in front of the Children's Wharf. That's where we had our album signing party, and Danny Hargrove and I are in the bow of the ship, full of people eating, drinking, dancing. They're blasting our album out over Boston Harbor. We're watching the jets take off from Logan, star-filled night, and just, how did we get here?
Yeah.
It was fantastic. But then, and then finally we're getting written up, and it seems like the project's finally going to happen, and we go to number one at a station out in California, and we're playing there, and we're all over Canada getting great write-ups, and then the great iceberg comes up out of the sea, and we ram right into it. It's Aerosmith.
Was that a Valentine's Day show at the Orpheum or something, and he got up on stage and played a song or something, or went backstage? Was that the thing? And was it Dufay said, hey, you really belong back in the band or something? Did I read that somewhere in one of the books?
Those all sound like bits and parts of story. I'm not sure if that's a mixed up story. And I just know from our angle. I know that Joe had gone to a Centrum Aerosmith show at the end of 83 just to hang out backstage with his old friends, and ended up with Steve, and this is when the substitute guitarists were the Aerosmith.
Crespo and Dufay.
Exactly. Yeah. And Aerosmith only got a few songs into the set, supposedly, at the Centrum when Steven Tyler keeled over. And everybody attacked Joe verbally, that Joe, it's your fault.
Yeah.
You brought something, and now Steven's out cold.
Yeah.
That was getting close. When that happened, Danny and I looked at each other and said, well, I guess that seals the deal. Joe is persona non grata still at Aerosmith, so bad news for Joe, but good news for the Joe Perry Project. Yeah. We'll still be working. But then that, in the beginning of 84, that that Alice Cooper thing kind of, Joe went and wrote some songs, supposedly, with Alice. I heard the tapes. Joe played them for me, and they didn't really sound like songs to me.
Yeah.
And then we were back on the road, but it wasn't very long until we got called into the office and told that Joe had decided that he had to go back with Aerosmith for a variety of reasons. Yeah. You know, our album had done all right, but there hadn't been any, you know, smash, more than a feeling kind of breakout hit out of it or anything. If, you know, if something like that had happened, which is pretty rare, out of a album with no, from a label that was not supporting the band at that time, for a huge breakout hit to happen.
But I was hearing, well, I guess it was maybe revealed in some of the books, but I even heard back then, you know, I'd go into Worlds and I'd hear little things here and there or to musicians that, basically, the Aerosmith management at the time was really trying to suppress anything that, you know, they didn't want the Joe Perry Project to ever get any traction at all. And Steven Tyler kept failing and having problems, and they didn't know this new version of Aerosmith was really going to keep flying. So, you know, you guys continued on even with that weight of you over you guys. And, you know, I do tip my hat to you because, you know, that's a lot of, you know, a lot of pressure.
Yeah, we heard that story not only with management trying to pressure Joe back into Aerosmith, but also that Columbia Records suppressed the Brad Whitford did the album with Derek Holmes.
Yeah, Whitford, Sam Holmes, yeah.
And that was buried, and the second Joe Perry Project album, they put nothing behind it at all. attempting to get the original Aerosmith back together because that was a cash cow for the company.
Yeah.
I understand why the Bean Counters would want to do that. They didn't know. I understand it's hard. I'm sure it was very hard for Joe to work with Steven at that point. Mm. Steven, incredible musician and brought so much to the table, but when Steven decided to drag his feet and not produce and not come up with lyrics for the songs that were already in the can otherwise, Joe was like, dude, get it together. Yeah. Sing the songs so we can finish the album. I want to get back on the road. Yeah. I'm getting old here. He wanted to rock every night.
Yeah.
You could tell in that thing we played a minute ago. He just wanted to go out and make a lot of crazy noise with his guitar. And that's what he did with the project. And Danny and I were full on board with that attitude.
Yeah.
And even though we weren't really getting paid.
Yeah.
Any money that came in was going to keep gas in the van and in our truck, keep the crew together, pay our, you know, bills at the Super 8 Motel, and whatever other money was going back to Joe's wife or to his management or to who his debtors to keep that, to stay out of jail, basically, and be able to go to the next gig. We were all looking towards the future as being what... looking to the future, better days ahead. But you know, the days were great. Every day of it was awesome.
And well, you must have known it was going to be an adventure from the jump.
I'm sorry, I didn't get.
You know, the minute you got involved with this project, it was going to be an adventure every day.
Yeah, I did, and that's why, you know, people are saying, "Wow, I can't believe you kept a diary." You know, that was really smart of you. No, I knew. I mean, I'd always kind of kept diaries anyway, but no, I knew I was going to keep a diary of this, and when it finished, you know, I was a psychological mess and a physical mess when the project ended, and I couldn't really read my own diary, and it took a lot of years before I was really ready to confront, because there's things in this book that some of it's really funny and really, I mean, that it was like number 17 in the travel humor thing on Amazon today. I saw, you know, a lot of people read it as a comedy, but there are some bits and pieces in here that are pretty sad and low down. I guess everything's got a funny edge to it, though.
I remember years ago when Spinal Tap came out, and Eddie Van Halen says, I didn't laugh to it. With it was too real.
Yeah, man. I remember going to that. I went to that movie. I was wearing my leather pants and my leather jacket. Mm. I said, oh, a Rob Reiner movie. This should be good. And yeah. You know, it was hilarious, and it's great. But, yeah, it was hard. It was poking a lot of holes in the kind of mainstream rock entertainment that we were dishing up.
Yeah.
And you know, and it was always hard because I had this other foot in the door with my old Thunder Train, the more city, the writers who always looked down at bands like Led Zeppelin and Aerosmith and Heart. You know, that was not the kind of stuff anybody wrote about.
Yeah.
They wanted to write about Cherry Vanilla and Wayne County and the Dead Boys.
Yeah.
And now, but I was in both camps. I could definitely hang with Wayne County and do those gigs, but I could hang with Joe Perry too and do that kind of gig.
Yeah.
And Spinal Tap, you know, definitely took the air out of some of our, you know, because we were puffed up. This was back in the days, you know, we played some big gigs, you know, in front of thousands of people, but we didn't have jumbotrons or lasers or all this stuff. It was basically like, go out there and jump up and down and entertain these 15,000 people. It was just us with our little selves putting on a big show as big as we could make ourselves. And so you have these aspects of Monster Truck and World Wrestling Federation that comes into it, that kind of big entertainment in big, big arenas and big festivals type places.
Well, what we'd like to do, we'd like to have you do another station ID, and then we're going to play another song and we'll be back.
All right. This is Cowboy Mark Bell on WMFO